Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by listener-supported community radio station, WFT. Okay, this is another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by listener-supported community station, WFT. Somebody was trying to call in to the studio line, and if you want to call in, you need to call the main number, 217-359, what is it, Bill?
9338.
We can't take any calls over the air yet. We are having a caller call in today from Washington State. He's an ex-member of the ex-staffer of the Carpenters Union. He's going to be talking about running for the regional council head there and everything. And he's got some very shocking information about the de-evolution of the Carpenters Union. But anyway, yes, we got quite an interesting show today. And also let you know that after our show ends, instead of playing the Union Edges as we normally do, we're going to be playing some audio clips of Gene Vanderport, who was interviewed on the Labor Hour in 2009. 2011 and also I think more recently in 2013, talking about various subjects. So stay tuned, for that. So Gus, I guess a little underwriting before you start though, we gotta say, the views and opinions expressed here, those speakers do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. And you're listening to World Labor Hour on 90.1 FM and webcast live worldwide at weft.org.
That's right. The Campus Faculty Association at the University of Illinois advocates for academic freedom, shared governance, and a strong faculty voice on campus. CFA is proud to support Community Radio and the Labor Hour in support of strong unions. You can learn more about the CFA by visiting cfaillinois.org. This hour program is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice hosts regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is important in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. And I guess we're going to start out with some headlines. I want to let people know that the new issue of the Public Eye is out.
Yes.
And it's dedicated in the memory of Gene Vanderport. Great photo on the front with Gene and past GEO member and president, Carrie Pimblot, holding a GEO banner at one of the demonstrations. There's a lot of other good articles in here. So, yes, pick up a copy of the Public Eye. It's available around Champaign-Urbana at various locations.
Yes, a great, already read it, read through. Just an amazing job by Brian Dolinar and the rest of the staff for the Public Eye. They did an amazing job with that. You know, Gene deserved this
yes.
special issue for everything he's done. And that's a great picture that they used.
Oh, indeed.
Without Gene, there would be no GEO. So I'm very happy about that.
Good. Okay, Gus, would you like to start? We got a lot of
There's been a lot of stuff going on in internationally, you know, with Turkey, nationally, in terms of police brutality protests and, you know, the issues with the public parties and the campaigns are now starting to actually come together to who's going to be vice president, who's going to be the convention starts Monday for the Republican. So there's a lot of delusion going around in this idea that there's a possibility that the Democratic Party, because Bernie is now supporting Hillary Clinton and gone off and given speeches, you know, that there is this, that there's a chance that some of his ideals and values that he shared during his campaign run are all of a sudden going to magically appear in Hillary Clinton's head and come out of her mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that really we have to understand. I was talking before the show with someone and we talked about this idea of alternative. When are the American masses going to really take into consideration that alternatives are not only needed, but immediately in terms of what's going on with this country? And I think that's a great thing for this show. And what we're going to talk about with these different stories is that there seems to be some type of, you know, some type of kind of this savior mechanism where we're hoping that somebody steps in. And then we can have some type of representative for our values and our interests to come in and do the work for us. I mean, we may be protesting, we may be doing this and that, but what are we really trying to do? What is the main objective of the American masses at this point as we continue to divide on income, on race, on gender, on international war? what is our main objective and what are we going to do about it? Mm-hmm. Because right now, I'm going to be honest with you, the news that, and the first story I wanted to start with is about Bernie Sanders backing Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and let's not forget, I mean, I think a big component of this is also working people in labor, organized labor.
Exactly.
You know, it's just, well, anyway, yeah, I don't want to, yeah.
No, you're right. And I think that's a major point that we have to understand is that even before Bernie endorsed Hillary, you had a lot of major labor organizations just telling their members, we're going to endorse Hillary Clinton. That should already
in the primaries,
yeah. Yeah, in the primaries. And this was even before the primaries that they were sending out these emails to the members and the locals. That should already tell working people that the labor movement in this current form cannot be the vanguard for any type of serious revolution or serious social change.
Yeah, but ultimately it has to be. That's the problem here is that the national union leadership is totally out of touch with its membership.
Yeah.
I mean, you saw like you were talking about AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, came out. They were, I think, one of the first ones to endorse Hillary Clinton, and others followed.
Yeah.
Almost all of organized labor did this, except for the UE, the National mm-hmm. Nurses Union, I think communication workers,
right.
And you know, a few others. But I know that there were lots and lots of locals that basically did, challenged this. I mean, yeah, basically, yeah. They said, no, we're not, you know, we voted as a local to endorse Bernie Sanders because yeah. That's what our members want. And not to mention the tons of rank and file people that by vast majority were supporting Bernie Sanders.
Exactly. And I think that's a great starting point for this is that ever since this endorsement, there have been tons of groups that have come out and completely condemned Bernie Sanders for supporting Hillary. You know, what he's been doing this past week, because I believe the announcement was made Monday, but
yeah.
People knew about it Sunday. What he's been doing all week is he's been scrambling to rally all of his supporters behind, you know, Hillary Clinton. So after the joint rally in New Hampshire where he endorsed Clinton on Tuesday publicly, but it had been announced Monday evening, Sanders met via conference call with his delegates to this month's Democratic Party National Convention in Philadelphia. During his call, Sanders patronized his supporters, telling them how much their political revolution had achieved.
Mm-hmm.
He boasted that discussion about social inequality and the corporate control of the political system have now become mainstream. And he claimed that the Democratic Party had adopted the most progressive party platform by far in its history.
That's delusional.
He actually said those things.
Yeah, I've got some stuff here I'm going to talk about today, specifics in regards to that whole Democratic Party platform meetings and stuff, and
yeah.
How one issue after another was crushed.
Oh, let's go through a couple of these.
Sure.
The full support to the Israeli regime and also the TPP agreement, which is backed by a consensus of the ruling class and the Obama administration to not only further isolate China, the platform committee, these are things that Sanders has not fully understood that this is what Clinton wants to do. She has become the corporate Democrat that they've all wanted. Things like TPP, things like healthcare, things like being pro-war. I mean, there are so many things to where Sanders, and I talked about this before the show.
Mm-hmm.
This is the year where Bernie Sanders could have looked at all those things and made a stand and said, no, we cannot support what the Democratic Party has been doing to working people anymore.
Yes.
And actually stood up with the Green Party or went by himself, whatever. He could have done something different.
Yeah, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, I mean, that is, oh my God. I mean, they've called it, I think the catchphrase is NAFTA on steroids, and that's not an overstatement. I mean, it's going to have such a horrible effect on labor, on unionization, on healthcare. It's going to prohibit single-payer healthcare. It's going to basically, not to mention the environmental problems. Basically, it's going to make world corporate companies completely unaccountable to any kind of domestic lawsuits, and it's actually going to prevent lawsuits from even being initiated because of the agreement. I mean, basically, you're talking about not only hurting working people, but it's going to be a complete sabotage of what little democracy we have in this country.
And that's the biggest thing about this, and let's put it in the context of history as well, that this is the next stage in neoliberalism. You know, you've had some type of cooperation where you have the privatization of private companies, the corporations having some type of check in regulation with the government, even though they still control governmental policies. Mm-hmm. But they're now, the TPP takes privatization and private corporations another step above governments to where they are now actually going to be pretty much invulnerable.
Yes.
Yeah, to everything that happens.
Yep.
So that they will not be hurt in any means of anything at this point. That they're basically empowering these corporations now to be
our rulers.
Indestructible. Yeah, exactly. A new ruling class of corporatization. That's the next stage in neoliberalism.
Yeah, which is going to make government irrelevant.
Exactly.
You know, that we elect. You know, even though we've got problems with it now, as far as we elect people that say they're going to do something, and then they sort of sit there and they hem and haw. You know, because they're in the back of their minds, they're thinking about all that corporate campaign money they got for, you know, in order to get elected.
Yeah.
You know, this is bad enough. Now, like you said, Gus, this is going to, you know, take it even to another level that's going to be worse for working people.
So what we have to do really is, at this point, like, what can we do? The first thing that we have to do is we have to organize in our communities and start going to city council meetings and other meetings where we have elected officials and telling them that we do not want either of these people to be our president, and we want you to not endorse them and to condemn them.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to change the narrative for the culture. There has to be a complete drastic complete overhaul of how we see the political parties in this country, because this could
based
be,
on facts, substantial
exactly.
fact. Yes,
we have to. But it's going to take a lot of work, though. We got to do a lot of organizing because this could be the year. This could be the year where you have somewhat of a general strike in the voting to stop voting for these two parties and say, we're not going to take this anymore.
Yeah.
There has to be a restructuring of the political system in this country. And Bill mentioned this before the show as well. It's about the value system. The only way it's going to work is if we restructure the cultural values of the people of this country through organizing and, like you say, using facts. But we have to make a stand this year, because I'm telling you, people don't see. Everybody keeps talking about this anti-Trump thing.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton is just as bad as Trump.
Yes. That's the thing.
And even Trump has even stated that he's possibly open to single payer health care.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Is the problem with Trump is he says one thing one day and says, you know, something to contradict it another, next week. But the real key interesting thing here is that I got a friend of mine. In fact, he's called in the show many times. His name's John Ryman. He's a retired union carpenter from Oakland, California. He reads the Wall Street Journal every day just to keep up what's going on in the capitalist class.
Yeah.
And he said that, of course, all of corporate America is behind Hillary Clinton, you know, because even though Trump's one of them, he's a billionaire, he's unpredictable. They don't know what to,
he's too volatile.
Yeah, but also
but he's not really one of them.
Well, he's a minor player.
He's got a lot of money, but he's just out there, man. But anyway, one last thing I want to mention. General strike.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right now we've had a general strike of voters for decades.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, and turnout in 2012 was 53.6%
mm-hmm.
in the United States. Mm-hmm.
And 2014, I believe it was only 40 some percent.
Yeah.
I think it was the lowest voter turnout since 1943, 1944 or something.
Got a double.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got a double.
Yeah.
That would be
probably 1946.
Perhaps.
Which was a really bad electoral year.
Too. Yeah.
That's when Taft-Hartley Act, the Republicans took Congress.
And that's also Wallace was denied Henry Wallace was denied the Democratic.
Great Iowa populist.
Yes, was denied by, pure brute force tactics at the Democratic Party convention in Chicago, you know,
mm-hmm.
preventing his delegates to get to the floor. When they went into that convention, Henry Wallace had the support of 70-some percent of Democrats, mm-hmm. you know, the polls nationwide of the rank-and-file Democrats and a majority of the delegates. And Truman only went in there with 7% support, and here he comes out the nominee, you know.
Amazing.
but there has to be some type of major catalyst to shake up, to start showing the value. And again, I don't want to take anything away from what Sanders did in opening the conversation.
Oh, yes, indeed.
In opening the conversation about class struggle. I appreciate that. But then again, it's not so one-dimensional as the 1% versus 99%. We can't use that model because it's not only ahistorical, because that's not how this country is founded, and that's not how social conditions are formed in this country. it doesn't work in the sense that there's a multidimensional range of people were forgetting that he's not talking about war overseas and the killings of the drone strikes, et cetera. He's not talking about imperialism. He's not talking about race. You know, mm-hmm. there's so many other aspects of society that won't be addressed. But like I said, I do appreciate bringing in the class struggle aspect because I argue that's something that the soft liberals and the conservatives have tried to erase from history is class struggle. Yes. So that's a major props for that. But now we have to think about where to go to next. We have to move further.
Yes.
Now.
Indeed.
Well, you know, I'm really looking at this large percentage of people who don't vote as a very large resource.
Well, that's the thing.
That needs to be reached. We were talking before the show sort of about like getting facts and things, and I was saying, well, you just can't – the people who are already conservative, like the Trump supporters, they've already got their set of facts, and they're going to have a lot of cognitive defenses to defeat. However, there's a huge number of people who don't, I believe that are very reachable, who are just completely disconnected from politics at all, on all levels in the United States, street, activist politics to voting and everything else. And I think those are the people, and those are the people that are living there on the east side of Urbana and some other places like that. And they're the people who, they will respond if people, take the time to talk to them.
Exactly. Yes.
You know, and that's what it, and I'm going to bring this up again. I haven't said anything about it for a while. We really need to be canvassing. We need to be in communities and talking to people. And one conversation is worth 10,000 campaign ads.
That's right.
Yeah, and most of these people you're talking about are poor and working class.
They're just, they're lower. They'll think of themselves as low middle class. Maybe, they're, and they're and these are mixed neighborhoods for the most part too.
Mixed racially. You know, the thing is I've seen least statistics I've seen is that okay, we know the voter turnout rate has been less than 50% of people that don't vote, you know. I mean I should say, there's a majority of people in this country who don't vote that do vote. And of the people who do vote, 40-some percent consider themselves independents. Only 20-some percent consider themselves Republicans and another 20-some percent consider Democrats.
Actually,
so the vast majority of the people are either independents or they don't get involved at all in voting.
And the Republicans and the Democrats are the tails on the ends of the normal curve here. You know, your normal person is somewhere, you know, not liking either one of them, but not necessarily leaning to a left or to a right position, or and maybe just has no positions on a lot of things.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. Well, we need to talk. We're going to talk some more later in the show about the Democratic Party platform, because I think that's really where the sort of the rubber hits the pavement, if you will, as far as what we're going to get in a sense of what Hillary Clinton. I mean. That won't do for sure, you know. You know,
I mean, it's not even a question of what she won't do. It's a question of how further she's going to drive the disparities in terms of wealth, race, gender, et cetera, in this country.
Indeed.
I mean, she's going to be very. I'm not saying that she's going to be reactionary. She's going to be very proactive in her driving of neoliberal. Just oppression in this country. She's very.
Which means lower wages, more insecurity in healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. We got a caller calling in here in about 5 minutes. I just want to throw a couple of real short, labor stories here. I guess there was a victory in Chicago. Chicago workers won a major victory a couple weeks ago after the earned sick day ordinance passed by the voters. Workers now have a right to take a day off when they are sick. They don't have to choose between their health and their jobs. I mean, you know, that's, you know, wow. It's amazing that we have to have voter referendums to get something like that, you know, passed. I guess one story about Trump, I guess the Wall Street Journal and USA Today uncovered a litany of lawsuits against the billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump, along with 25 complaints to the Department of Labor. Mm-hmm. Plumbers, painters, waiters, dishwashers, and carpenters alleged they were not paid for their work. Apparently, Trump really means it when he says he's not going to pay for construction on his hypothetical wall.
Yeah. Well, Dave, on that subject, I might direct people to IBEW.org, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.org, Media Center, an article titled, Does Trump Build Union? An IBEW investigation. And one of the things I'd like to find out more about is the Polish demolition workers on the Trump Tower project.
Oh, yes.
Like 200.
Undocumented workers, right?
Now, here's the thing. See, that came out in a lawsuit that was filed by an individual member of the building wreckers local.
Oh, really?
And see, the building wreckers are part of the laborers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering what kind of hanky-panky went on there between Trump and the laborers.
In New York City?
Right, yeah. To allow those 200 Polish workers who were working under terrible safety conditions.
Yes.
And okay, we got a caller. Call.
Yes, yeah. We got a caller, okay. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, it's John Torkelson calling in. How's it going?
Good, John. Okay, so could you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Sure. My name is John Torkelson. I'm a 20-year member of Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, United Brotherhood of Carpenters. I worked for the council as a trustee on our pension and as a business agent for almost 10 years. And I was elected as a rank-and-file member to as executive secretary, or not executive secretary, I'm sorry, financial secretary of the largest local in our council. It's a 3,500-member local, so it's a fairly decent-sized local.
Okay.
And I'm running against Doug Tweedy now in the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters for the executive secretary position.
Okay, that's a large district council, regional council, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about 20,000 members. We're six states. We're Alaska, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming.
Oh, my gosh. That's going to be yes. That's a huge area to campaign in if you want, you know, you have to go to each local.
Yeah, luckily I've got a wife that does really good and supports me 100%. She's been with me since I've been about a third period apprentice. And she's seen what this organization has gone through and she's seen what it's done to the working guys out there in the direction that Doug Tweedy's taken us. And she's, you know, do it full time. And June 1st, I asked for a layoff from my employer and I've been campaigning full time. I'm on my second and third visit to every local union in our council's jurisdiction.
Now, from what I understand, you used to actually be a staffer for the regional council. Is that correct?
Yeah, I came on staff and worked for about 10 years. And, you know, back what happened was, you know, and I believe me, I believed in what the general president was telling us. I believed in the message. I believed in this area's standards. And I was one of the foot soldiers. I was one of the loyal employees of the UBC and the council, and when the mergers happen, I don't know what's going on in Illinois with the mergers. If you guys have been subject to the closing of the locals and the consolidating,
yes,
of the locals,
we have. But, yes, mm-hmm.
But when that happened, you know, I believe it. You know, we were told we were going to lower the dues of the members. We were going to take these outdated, antiquated locals that haven't had, you know, they were chartered 100 years ago, and they really hadn't progressed with the times. You know, some of those locals were still doing things longhand by, you know, writing them out and photocopying records and their statements. And so when we were told that we were going to bring these up to modern, you know, 21st century locals, I believed it. And then shortly thereafter, you start saying, well, why are they chartering these locals in the most distant reaches of these states? You know, the most difficult places for members, especially members getting off work, to come and attend their union meetings. You know, we had these viable locals in these large metropolitan areas, but yet then we go and charter, when we merge three locals together, we put them in the most distant, remote spot in the council. Then we would open up informational meetings, and they go, wow, these informational meetings are really popular. Well, that's because they're in the core, they're in the city cores where people can get to, and they say, well, but nobody wants to go to union meetings because they're an hour and a half out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And so
okay.
I started seeing there that this wasn't for the benefit of the members. It was more, in my opinion, it was to consolidate power and to seize assets. And
yes.
And that's the only thing that I've seen happen out of these mergers.
Indeed, indeed. I've seen this phenomenon going on for quite a few years now, not just here in Illinois, but, you know, my carpenter contacts in other states, in Georgia and other places. It's the same picture. It's the same pattern, you know. Now, I understand that when you were basically a staffer, that you were on the pension board.
Yeah, I was a trustee, and we've got four pensions that are in our council. And the Western Washington pension, which includes Seattle and the Puget Sound area, is the strongest pension in our council. It's a $1.7 billion pension plan.
Wow!
It's been the cornerstone of our pensions in our council, and it's always been in the green. We've always had great trustees running this pension, but about the time of the mergers, our pension plan started getting in trouble, and we weren't getting those annual funding statements. And you see, that our funding every year was going down, and we lowered our accrual rate. You know, we took our accrual rate from 4% and lowered it down to 1.5%, which took the pension and cut that monthly amount that people would get for a full year's worth of work over in half. So you went from about a $200 benefit a year down to about an $80 benefit a year. And we were told that's only supposed to be temporary until the funding comes up. And then we end up diverting $1.25 per an hour is going into that pension, or and it's non-accruing. So you got this, and that was supposed to be temporary. But yet, when every contract's bargaining, we don't put new money into the pension. We would not negotiate new money in that pension. Actually, our CEO, EST, would come out and say, hey, the pension's safe, no money's needed. Yet when you surveyed the members, like at this last contract we just had in June, 2015, the biggest construction boom in the history of the Puget Sound, we've got over 60 tower cranes in downtown Seattle alone. And back when I was an apprentice, if you wanted a union job, you went and found a tower crane. We had 100%. 99% tower cranes were union in Seattle, and now less, by the council's own admission, less than half of them are 50%. Wow. And when they tell you that, when they tell you, hey, don't worry about it, we got the concrete. And I'm going, wait a minute, all those UBC videos we've been watching, you guys talk about in the 70s when we circled the wagons and said, hey, don't worry about it, we got commercial concrete downtown. That's right there on the UBC video. So we're talking the exact same thing 30, 40 years later. We're saying, hey, don't worry about it. I know it looks bad, but we're circling the wagons and we're protecting concrete. So
okay, and so they basically were intentionally underfunding the pension. Is that correct?
Well, because this is my belief. So I kept going to Doug Tweedy and saying, "Hey, Doug, we got to put money into this pension. Don't worry about it. Even with the funding every year was going down. Don't worry about it. The pensions are safe. The pensions are safe. We were over 95% funded prior to the 2008 crash." And now in 2015, we're down to 82% funded. And I made a video back over a year ago, last May, and that was my claim. I said, hey, the reason we're not bargaining for new contributions going into this plan is because they're going to intentionally underfund it, and when it gets into trouble, they're going to throw their hands up and say, hey, this plan's not viable anymore. We need to move into a 401k.
401k? Oh, my God. I mean, that's part of one of the big benefits of being in a union is my co-hosts are going wild on this one. A fine benefit plan is like a core of being in a union.
Right.
A lot of building trades are doing those though, Dave. It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
The other trades are.
Yeah. This is the first time I've heard
By the
about
way, I'm a laborer.
Okay.
So what happened was when I made this video saying that they were going to intentionally do this, they came, all the union reps went to the meetings and they said, hey, this guy is just disgruntled. He got fired. You know, he's just trying to stir the membership up. And then smash cut to, 90 days ago at our last delegate meeting, our EST CEO gets up there and says, well, I'm sorry to report, but our pension's in trouble and we're going to have to look at going into a variable annuity. They've done it in Alaska's pension. They came in, Alaska's pension was in trouble. They moved them into what's called a variable annuity pension.
Mm-hmm.
They're in the process of doing that in Eastern Washington, and now they're in the process of doing that in Western Washington, my pension.
Wow. So you're basically going to be running against this Tweedy guy and everything, and I mean, I know there's probably some other issues besides the pension and also losing union work. It seems like it's going more and more non-union and stuff. There's some other issues too that you're going to be talking about in your campaign.
Well, and that's the way to solve this pension problem. You know, there's two. You got to get the funding up.
Sure.
And while we've got this incredible boom, I mean, it is so exploding in Seattle right now. If you want to work, you can come to Seattle. If you got concrete experience, they're hiring everybody. The books are empty. We can't strip guys off the job sites. And so we got drywallers too that are, I was talking to a superintendent last night and he was telling me that he's got three projects that he's going to have to turn down because he can't get drywallers.
Wow.
Out there.
Wow.
And so that, we got the CIA program called the Carpenters in Action. You know, it started in Northern California. It's come up here. But what they're using this program for is to build fences, to build ramps, or for community involvement. That CIA program and our focus, just like the general president said, you know, back in 95, the main thing's got to be the main thing. We got to get back all hands on deck and organize, and do everything we can to, it couldn't be better conditions right now for organizing. You've got so much work out there. We've got a shortage of workers. I mean, right there spells for great organizing opportunities.
Oh, indeed. So. Yes, indeed. You know, you had a lot of issues here and everything. And when's your election, by the way?
The election will be August 20th of this year. So okay. We're full on boogie. I'm going up to Alaska. I'm going back to Montana here next week.
Oh, my gosh.
Some campaigning there. And
wow.
Been down in Oregon, been all over this council.
Do you have a private plane or something? I mean, that's a huge geographical area.
Yeah, I got a Prius. So.
Okay.
There you go. That's how I'm doing it.
Okay. Yeah.
I know it's not a union made car, but you know what? They build Michael's Toyota here in our area builds everything union. They built a big parking structure and
okay.
So that's kind of how I say I can drive a Toyota when I need to versus a good American made car.
Okay. And in addition to these issues, what would you say the big difference is between the current CEO Tweety? I mean CEO, wow, and yourself.
Well, one of the issues is I cannot believe that he self-appointed himself as a CEO of a labor organization.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were being, facetious there. He actually calls himself that?
Yeah, he turned that when he got elected. He put that on his business cards, and we're all just scratching our heads, going, "Wait a minute, we're not a business. We are a labor organization. We have labor leaders, not CEOs." So, I think the biggest thing between me and Doug is I think that our membership is a lot smarter than he gives us credit for. We've had him tell us, this is a quote from him, that even if he had time to explain it to you, you wouldn't understand it, so I'm not going to explain it to you. And that was talking about our pension plan.
Wow.
We are kept in the dark on everything. And one of the things that needs to happen is everybody's talking about transparency. We don't have transparency in our organization. We get stuff shoved down our throats. We get told that our pension plan is safe. We get told that our work hours are picking up. I've been told so many times in Seattle, hey, work's picking up. But when you go to the trust and you look at the trust hours that are being reported to the trust, they're flat. With the biggest construction boom in the history of the Puget Sound, we're bumping along at 1.1 million hours a month, and that's where we've stayed for the last couple of years. So hours aren't picking up. So I think transparency and being able to communicate with the members that are in our area. I've gone to every union hall 2 or 3 times now. You know how many times our ESG's been seen at these locals in the last 2 years? Zero. He doesn't attend union meetings. He doesn't return phone calls. And so that's my biggest thing. I think when given the right information to the members, and you say, if this variable annuity pension is such a great thing to go into, we need to be out explaining it to the members and saying, hey, this is what we believe we need to go into. And if the members believe it and members say, Doug, that is a good idea, let's go into it. But if the members say, no, it's not a good idea, guess what? We need to fight.
Yeah,
and that's what we're not doing. Democracy to me.
Yeah, indeed.
Exactly. And if we make a mistake, if the group makes a mistake and we screw up, well, guess what? We're all educated. We all understand what we did. Now we realize it's a mistake. Now let's all work together to fix it.
Indeed. Well, listen, I would really like if we could arrange it. I know it's going to get really crazy the closer you get to the actual election, but we'd love for you to call in August, shortly before the election and give us an update and stuff, because I imagine a lot of interesting stuff's going to be happening between now and then. But, for today, just some last words on your part, to the end of the interview. How people can contact you.
People can contact me at johntorkelson.com, johntorkelson.com. I'm on Facebook. You can hit me up on Facebook. The thing I think the greatest thing about it is, though, I feel kind of like Bernie Sanders at times. I've been a complete underdog throughout this entire race, and one of my key points is we need solidarity. We need to be in that building trades. We withdrew out of the building trades over 8 years ago, and it's been a battle. We're fighting not only the non-union, we're fighting our brothers and sisters that are in the building trades. So I went to the building trades and I talked to them about the day I get elected, I want to reaffiliate with the building trades. We were on board with it. We were going to do this because I believe that we've got some big fights coming up and we can't do this alone. So a couple days ago, after I went to the building trades, it was announced by our CEO that we reaffiliated with the building trades in Washington State. So I felt like I had a part in that, and I felt like that's a really good direction. So.
Oh, indeed. I mean, I remember when McCarran pulled out of the AFL-CIO in the building trades, back in 2001. I don't know a single working carpenter that supported that. I mean,
no.
It was just, we had no vote on that at all, and I think that's an excellent you know, move on your part as well, because I think it's practical as well as a good, you know, a moral decision. Because let's face it, I mean, working people have it hard enough the way it is, and it's getting worse. We need to stick together, and whatever we can do to, you know, to form unity and stuff, that's what we got to do. And I think that would be a good step forward on that one. John, this has been a great interview, and like I said, I'll be talking to you, and we'd love to get an update from you right before the election, because, man, I'll tell you, besides being a retired union carpenter, I think, you know, this is critical for the whole labor movement, you know, I think this is a very important issue that listeners need to hear about.
Yep, believe me, I think the same thing. I think if we make a stand here, this could send a message not only to this region, but could send a message UBC-wide that, hey, you know what, we're tired of it. We're tired of not having a say. We're tired of not being involved. We're tired of no democracy in our organization. So,
indeed.
Thanks a lot, and okay. I will call you back.
All right, John, thank you. Take care.
Take care.
Goodbye.
The good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Okay, we're back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on the supported community radio station WAFT in Champaign, Illinois, broadcasting at 90.1 FM in Central Illinois, and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. Some quick public service announcements. Tune in today, this Saturday at 2 p.m. and every Saturday for None Another Sports Show with host fellow worker Neil Parthen, and that's on WRFU 104.5 FM, and also on the internet at www.wrfu.org. And also this Sunday and every Sunday, tune in to Labor's Worldview TV on Comcast Channel 6 and also live on the internet at www.urbanapublictelevision.org. This Sunday's episode at 4 p.m. is with Gene Vanderport. This segment was done back in early 2012 during the height of the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. And it's a good little 30-40 minute interview, live interview on TV with Gene. And also, I'd let you know, next Sunday on the 24th of July, we're going to be having a really interesting program about the history of U.S. government overthrow of democracies over time, which I think is a very critical one to know about, especially coming in this election year with foreign policy issues, which have been definitely avoided for the most part. So other than just some
bomb everybody,
take their stuff. So Bill, you found something about the what I kind of was talking about earlier about Trump. What you said was about bringing in Polish undocumented workers to work on the Trump demolition in New York City?
Yeah, this is from the New York Daily News, dated Monday, March 8th, 1999.
Okay.
20 years after a squad of non-union Polish demolition workers cleared the way for Trump Tower by tearing down the old Bonwit Teller building on Fifth Avenue, Donald Trump has quietly settled a lawsuit brought on their behalf. The lawsuit against Trump was filed in 1983 by a crusty ex-boxer and dissident member of the House Wreckers Union named Harry Diduck. That's D-I-D-U-C-K. It was Diduck's claim that Trump had cheated Laborers Local 95 out of at least $300,000 in contributions to its benefits funds by secretly employing the non-union workers. The workers, many of them undocumented immigrants, sweated through round-the-clock shifts, and some even slept on the floors of the building they were demolishing.
Oh, my gosh.
They were promised $4 to $5 an hour, but many were stiffed for even those low wages. And probably at the time, the laborer's scale would have probably been, I don't know, maybe $15 an hour.
In New York City, I don't think
so. In the early 1980s, Dave.
Oh, in the early 1980s?
Yeah, this would have been 1982 or three.
Okay.
Even though the article was 1999.
Okay.
So it was still fairly low wages, and they didn't even get them. Trump dismissed the charges, saying that violations were the fault of an inept demolition contractor whom he later fired. But Dyduck, the latest unlikeliest foe for glamorous real estate tycoon, stuck to his guns and did so his lawyers, the late Bird Hall, a prominent labor lawyer, and his partner, Wendy Sloan. After a trial in 1991, federal judge Charles Stewart ruled that the Trump Organization and its partner, Equitable Life Assurance Company, Society, conspired with a former union leader to withhold $325,000 in benefit payments plus interest, adding up to about $4 million.
And it was in the laborers,
Yes, the laborers union, probably okay. Their local business manager.
Okay.
You know, I would guess.
Mm-hmm.
An appeals court ordered the case retried, and that is where it was headed until last month's settlement agreement, which was placed under seal. Neither side would give specifics. It has been resolved on terms agreeable to both sides, said Sloan, who is joined by lawyers Lewis Steele. Dyduck died in 1992. Quote, he never stood to make a nickel, Sloan said. The money was to go to the union funds. Also, thanks to courageous rank-and-file dissidents like Harry, justice is finally catching up to Trump Tower, said James McNamara of the Association for Union Democracy.
Yeah, and their corrupt union leadership. I mean, oh, my God, that's not just not getting representation. That's getting undermined and betrayed.
Yeah. Well, I wonder how many no-show jobs they got for the mob on that.
Yes. I got a real quick one here in Illinois. Are paying their gain, just like big banks profiting from toxic waste swaps or payday loan sharks. Former Governor Illinois Governor Jim Edgar has joined the vultures, cashing in on the pain and desperation of others. It's a tried and true system. Use power and policy to create hardship. Example, budget cuts, elimination of good jobs. Dangle short-term relief to the desperate. In other words, loans that mostly benefit the already rich and powerful and keep people desperate. This new variation offers loans to social service agencies, which have been cut off from state funding or funding reduced, which they wouldn't need if the state would just fund the services, then collect the interest when the state eventually pays the bill. It's hundreds of millions of dollars in profit to these vultures, and the impasse adds more to the eventual taxpayer cost for the services. But no worry, that extra goes to the rich and the banks. Yep, these budget policies are expanding business opportunities in Illinois, all right, cashing in on the desperation of others and defrauding the taxpayers.
Wow. Oh, by the way, Dave, I do want to mention, when I read that article, that came from a website, a really fascinating website I hadn't been to for a long time called laborers.org.
Okay.
Which is a dissident website which has everything that you could ever imagine knowing about the laborers, the Teamsters, and the mob.
Okay. And you'd have to, in the New York City area, you could throw the carpenters in there because, man, there's quite a history there, too. Not to mention the longshore, that is the ILA, mm-hmm. the East Coast longshoreman, which is different than the West Coast longshoreman. But, yeah, I tell you, corruption, organized crime in the unions, I mean, this goes way back in New York City. I mean, back into the, 1890s, 19-teens, you know.
Right.
So, okay, guess what else is going on that's come across your radar this week or today or whatever?
Well, it's a lot, and we'll save some of the stuff for when we talk about the Democratic Party, and mm-hmm. talk about the protest for police brutality.
Yes, indeed.
And one of the things that we have to make sure that we keep in contact with is what's going on in terms of economic disparity, and that's why we can't really use that 1% versus 99% because there's so many layers to class struggle mm-hmm. that it has to be a lot more complex. So there's this new study that just came out. A significant majority of the population in 25 of the world's most advanced countries experienced declining or stagnating incomes between 2005 and 2014. And this study was done by the McKinsey Global Institute. An estimated 540 million to 580 million people, which is 65 to 70% of the populations of these countries, had real incomes that were flat or fell during that period. These countries whose total population is 800 million account for half of the world's economic output. Never before in the post-World War II period has such a large section of workers in advanced capitalist countries faced such a decline or stagnation in income. In contrast, during the period between 1993 and 2005, the study estimates that only 2% of the population in the same countries experienced similar conditions. So again, this is something that we're starting to see, because a lot of, there wasn't a really good way to gauge the consequences and ramifications behind what happened in 2008 recently. But mm-hmm. now that we're far removed in terms of length from when it happened in 2008, we're 8 years after it now.
Yeah.
We're starting to see some really nasty consequences that have happened to the entire world, particularly the working class populations across the world. We're seeing incomes, we're seeing wealth stagnating and falling completely.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing a rise in sub-working class work in many of these capitalist countries.
Deterioration of public yeah. social services, yeah. attacks on public education. I mean, yeah.
Exactly. So now, what we're saying is that you're going to start seeing more and more studies come out now that are they're being able to analyze what happened in relation to 2008, 2009 on a global and national scale.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to see just, and this is some really good data that's coming out that we can use to show just how not only the upper classes and the capitalist classes got away with destroying communities and destroying people's livelihoods, but also how the working class people are just basically drowning in a lot of these problems that are happening across the world.
Yeah.
So this is some really good stuff that's coming out, and I'm glad that you have people like McKinsey Global Institute that are doing these types of data reports, but we just need to spread them out now so that people can see this is something that's going to drastically affect what happens these next few years.
Indeed.
Yeah,
indeed.
Stuff is continues to fall.
Yeah, and we're going to touch on this again when we get later in the program here to talk more about the Democratic Party and its platform. I want to get a couple of international news stories here. The South Korean government wants an 8-year jail sentence for Hang Sang-yum, president of the Militant Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, for his role in last year's mass rallies against labor law rollbacks.
Mm.
Han faces 8 charges, all traffic and public safety violations. He was elected in 2014 in the Federation's first ever direct Democratic vote, pledging to organize a general strike. And he got elected by a huge percentage of his members.
I like that word.
Yes, indeed. And a little closer to home in Chiapas. Oh, there's been some interesting stuff going on there with the teachers' unions and stuff. Listeners may remember back in, when was that, Bill or Gus? Back in, I think it was 2010 or 2012, there was a huge battle of teachers against the state government in Oaxaca, in which the teachers' union and other unions and other working class organizations completely took over the city of Oaxaca for a couple
2011,
weeks.
2011.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yes. Well, anyway, I guess the CNTE teachers' unions hold a rope as they march against President Enrique Peña Nieto's education so-called reforms. Popular support for the teachers has especially come from the southern region of Mexico that has historically been stricken by violence and poverty. A highway blockade in support of Mexico's striking teachers increasingly gaining popular support in the capital of the southern state of Chiapas.
Mm.
Their protest in the city of Tuxtla Gutierrez is being organized as a popular assembly and has remained active for 15 days. That's where basically working people have pretty much taken over governing the city, gathering up to 3,500 demonstrators in support of the teachers union. I guess teachers and parents from impoverished neighborhoods, medical students, indigenous associations, and grassroots movements in this area of Mexico have also joined the blockade as part of a nationwide protest against President Enrique Peña Nieto's neoliberal education so-called reform, which is basically privatization of education. Popular support of the teachers' cause in Mexico has been concentrated in the southern state of Oaxaca, Guerra, Tabasco, and Chiapas, a region historically subject to violence and poverty, but also rich in social struggle. Meanwhile, CNTE teachers leaders are holding negotiating talks over the controversial so-called reform with the government at the Interior Ministry in the headquarters of Mexico City. And so far in the ongoing talks, government officials have shown no willingness to negotiate any point of the education so-called reform. So we'll keep you posted on that. But, I don't see any of that in the corporate media.
No, you're not going to see that kind of stuff. And that's why they're allowing so many national things to happen, and they're equating it with certain groups. You know, they don't want there to be the actual, or they don't want there to be any type of radical or militant action involved. They don't mind if somebody has protests. They don't, you know, because it's easy to just go on social media and invite people to come to a protest rally.
Sure,
they don't have an issue with that. But when you start actually seeing people going into communities and having political education sessions and organizing them and doing what just
and
happened,
doing actions,
actually doing actions that disrupt the flow of capital and disrupt businesses. And I'm not talking about once or twice. I mean, I'm glad that there were highways shut down here for police brutality, but you have to do it consistently. While somebody did something in LA, there should have been the next highway shut down in Seattle, or the next one shut down in Atlanta. You know what I'm saying? Like every other day or so, like organize something like that to where things are disruptive.
Yes.
You know, that's not happening at a powerful scale right now. There are lots of great local movements happening here that local people are standing up and fighting and things like that. But again, the two major problems with the way protests are working here and movements in general, is that number one, there is no class analysis and capital is not critiqued as being part of the problem itself. Number two, there's really no push for an objective. One of the things that we have to take from the 60s and 70s, from all groups, going back to civil rights movement, black power movement, women's liberation movements, LGBTQ movements, all the movements, there was an objective and there was a strategy to get to said objective.
Yes, and the same thing in the labor movement in the 1930s.
1930s, yeah, exactly.
I mean, factory occupations, all sorts.
Yeah.
I mean, workplace occupations in general.
There was a list of what we're going to do to get to those demands. There's nothing happening here except a lot of upset people.
Yes.
And that's why we can't move forward until we take, and that's one of the biggest things from Alden Morris's amazing book, The Origins of the Civil Rights Movement, and other social movement theorists like Craig Calhoun, they talk about, is that you have to move from that upset infra-political stage, because it's just a bunch of fervor and anger, which is good. You have to be angry to do something, but sooner or later you have to coalesce it into an organized and structured discipline and disruptive mechanism.
A tactical action.
Exactly,
yes.
It has to be tactical. That's a great word for it.
Yes.
We haven't gotten to that stage yet. There's been a lot of movement stuff that has been ignited. There are moments of really good fire in this country since 2013. But there hasn't been that next step hasn't been taken yet.
Indeed.
And that's really disheartening for the local people who are putting their lives on the line to go to these things and the, you know, risking, you know, like, yeah, this go to some protests and things like that. But there needs to be a step forward. I'm still waiting on a list of demands from certain groups that want to protest things. And it's just, it drives me crazy, because one of the things the Panthers did immediately after forming, they issued their demands before they even did a protest. Like, this is who are we? What do we want?
Yes.
What do we want to happen? The big problem is that there are so many of these groups that are involved in these protests that are in bed with these soft liberals and these Democrats that don't want to push the envelope on capital. They don't want to push the envelope on moving away from the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like I said, they're playing political points here. So that nobody wants to really put their neck out there and say, this is the problem with the police. They have too much power to do things to society. This is the problem with wealth disparity. This is the problem with this. Nope, they don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And they don't want to equate those struggles as being intersected. That's a major problem why you see so many great protests happening, but then that's it.
Yeah.
There's nothing else.
Yes, yes, yes. Indeed. And this goes back to the, you know, labor movement back into the late 1800s. Agitate, educate, organize, mobilize.
Exactly.
And I mean, the mobilization is lame at best, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like you said, you know,
I'm tired of these hashtags.
Yes, yes. Okay.
I'm sick of this. Hashtag stop killing my people. Would you think the racists care about that?
Yeah.
That's why I don't hashtag that garbage.
Yeah.
Because the racists sitting there like, make me.
Yeah.
That's what they're saying. Make me stop killing your people.
Yeah. I just don't get Twitter.
Well,
I never have.
Yeah.
I mean, what it is number one, it's useful for the ruling class to totally take away any type of educational focus for working people and for the,